Good morning. This is welcome to the hearing of the House Tribal Affairs Committee. We will now come to order. The time is 8:05 a.m. Thursday, March 12, 2026, in Capitol Room 106. Members present for House Tribal Affairs are Representative Schwanke, Representative Freer, Representative Story, Representative Carrick. Representative Underwood will be joining us shortly, and myself, Chair Dybert. Let the record reflect that we have a quorum to conduct business. A quick reminder to please silence your cell phones. Before we begin, I'd like to thank Jordan Nicholson, the Tribal Affairs Secretary from Records, and Susan Quigley from the Juneau LIO for staffing the committee today and keeping us running smoothly. Thank you so much. We have one item on the agenda this morning. We will have a presentation from Yukon River Drainage Fisheries Association on their partnership and programs in the Yukon River Drainage. This is especially important to me, not only as an Interior representative, but as a Koyukon woman whose family comes from Rampart and Cochrane, Alaska, and has been grieving the loss of salmon on this river system. Today we are joined virtually by YRDFA, Y-R-D-F-A, Executive Director Serena Alstrom, as well as Brian McKenna, who is the fisheries biologist for the organization, and they're online. Before I hand it over to Ms. Alstrom and Mr. McKenna, I would like to take a moment to recognize that today, March 12th, is Ashley Johnson Barr Day. Ashley was a young girl from Kotzebue, Alaska, who was taken from this earth far too soon. She was known for her bright smile, her kindness, and love of the color purple, which I'm happy to see members wearing today in her honor. I would like to ask us to take a moment of silence to recognize Ashley, our missing and murdered relatives, and the loved ones impacted by these horrible acts of violence. Anabasi, thank you so much. Thank you for the committee's indulgence. We will now move on to today's presentation. Ms. Alstrom, I believe I can see you online. Good morning. And Mr. McKenna, welcome to Tribal Affairs. Can you hear us okay?
Yes, I can. Thank you.
Wonderful.
Good morning. I can hear you. Thanks.
Wonderful. We could hear you guys perfect, loud and clear. Please put your name on the record and proceed with your presentation. I'm looking forward to learning and having great conversation on this topic. Good morning.
Good morning. Well, thank you, Chair Dybert, for having us present about our organization for the record. My name is Serena Alstrom. My Yupik name is Juchicho, and I am the Executive Director of the Yukon River Drainage Fisheries Association.
And Mr. McKenna?
Good morning. For the record, my name is Brian McKenna. I am the fish biologist on staff with YRDFA. Thank you.
Wonderful. Good morning. Thank you both for being here today. Please begin your presentation.
Well, again, for the record, again, this is Serena Alstrom. We could stay on slide one. We'll do an introduction of the organization. The Yukon River Drainage Fisheries Association's mission is to protect and promote all wild fisheries and traditional cultures within the Yukon River Drainage. The organization is founded on some core values that we practice. I'll go ahead and provide those. The first one is to sustain wild salmon fisheries and other natural resources in the Yukon River watershed, to to maximize fishing opportunity for people living along the Yukon River, promote understanding, communication, and cooperation between fishery users, have fair play, equity, and sharing, to empower people and build their capacity to participate in fisheries management decision-making, assist the people and the natural resources they depend on, and the final one is do unto others as you would have others do unto you. These core values were set by our board when they first developed. And you could move on to slide 2, please.
We're coming. Hang on.
Oh, okay. So the Yukon River Drainage Fisheries Association, better known as YRDFA, has its roots in a critical moment of sharing concerns among local fishermen back in 1990. That year, a historical gathering took place in Galena, Alaska, that was spurred by the alarming declines in the Chinook salmon population, a species vital to the cultural subsistence and economic well-being of the region. This meeting was remarkable because it successfully brought together fishermen from both the lower and the upper stretches of the Yukon River, communities that often had historical disagreements and differing perspectives on fishery allocations and resource management. Critically, instead of devolving into arguments or attempts to point blame for the declining salmon returns, the fishermen focused on a unified, proactive solution. They recognized that the magnitude of the problem required collective action and a shared voice. The direct result of this historical meeting was the decision to formally establish the Yukon River Drainage Fisheries Association, founded on the principle of cooperation and the commitment to sustainable management of the Yukon River fisheries resource, aiming to protect the interests and traditional ways of life for all communities within the vast Yukon River drainage. And could move on to slide 3, please.
Good morning again. For the record, this is Brian McKenna. This slide here kind of shows, and we'll talk about the Yukon River drainage and then those who YRDFA serves. The Yukon River is the largest river in Alaska. It is also the fifth largest drainage in North America. The Yukon starts in Canada in northern British Columbia, and it flows for over 2,300 miles on its way to the mouth with the Bering Sea. It drains an area approximately 300, the size of about 330,000 square miles. So it's an immense river basin, which is home to a diverse array of communities and political entities across the United States and Canada. Within Alaska, the Yukon watershed encompasses 56 different Alaska communities, many of which are heavily dependent on the Yukon River's natural resources, and particularly Yukon River salmon. The region is also characterized by a significant presence of indigenous government structures, which include 50 different Alaska tribes or federally recognized or traditional tribal entities within the Alaska portion of the drainage. And it also includes 14 First Nations in the Canadian portion of the drainage. Economically and culturally, the river supports various stakeholders involved in the resource utilization, and YRDFA supports all of these fisheries and resource users along the entire river drainage. So that includes subsistence fishermen and communities, includes commercial entities as well, such as Yukon River processors, and also sport fishermen who recreational fish throughout the river. Next slide, please.
For the record, my name is Serena. The Yukon River Drainage Fisheries Association Board is structured to ensure comprehensive and equitable representation across the entire river watershed. A key element of this structure is the staggered election process, which promotes consistency and smooth transitions within the leadership. every member of the board and their representative or respective alternates must either be actively fishing or reside within the specific district they are elected to serve. This requirement guarantees that the directors possess firsthand localized knowledge of the issues and concerns facing the region. To further ensure board geographical representation throughout the river, YRDFA had implemented a rule limiting the number of board members from the same community within the certain districts to no more than two. This prevents any single community from disproportionately influencing the board's decision. The board composition has evolved over time to become more inclusive and representative of the entire drainage. The board later formally added two non-voting seats, specifically representatives from the Canadian sections of the Yukon River drainage, recognizing the shared nature of the resource. Most recently, in 2016, the board introduced two seats designed for young fishers, a progressive step taken to engage the next generation of harvesters and ensure their perspectives of integrated into the organization's strategic planning and advocacy efforts. Next slide, please.
For the record, this is Brian McKenna. So this slide, it shows a list of our current staff, and I won't go through there and read each position and person, but YRDFA is a 501c3 nonprofit Alaskan entity. We currently have 8 full-time employees and 1 part-time, along with 2 seasonal positions. And currently, this is the largest staff that YRDFA has employed, and it's 36 years. For many of those years, the organization consisted of just 1 or 2 full-time employees. And, you know, as a nonprofit, we are subject to kind of the ebb and flow of the availability of funding. And that directly impacts the size of our staff and then the ability for our staff to achieve the mission. And we're always looking for funding to sustain our staff and to achieve our objectives. Next slide, please.
Mr. McKenna, before we on that slide, I have a question. What does TEK stand for technician? That shows vacant.
Yes, thank you for that question. That stands for traditional ecological knowledge.
And that position is vacant. Or is it filled now?
It is vacant currently. Serena, hop in if you need to correct me, but I believe that position is currently being advertised.
Yes, through the chart, that is correct.
Okay, thank you. Please proceed. Oh, before we move to the next slide, I'd like to, for the record, welcome Representative Ruffridge to the committee at 8:19.
For the record, this is Brian McKenna. And on the next slide here, you'll see YRDFA's strategic plan. This strategic plan was developed in 2009 by our full board of directors. And since its creation, the strategic plan will get updated every 5 years during annual board meetings. You'll see 4 long-term goals here that were established to help achieve YRDFA's mission. And underneath each goal, there's also a subset list of specific objectives that have been created to help guide our activities and efforts. I'll go through and read these. I don't like reading from slides, but I'll cover these. The first goal here is to reduce riverwide conflict and coordinate a riverwide approach to fishers and tribes' involvement in sustainable fisheries management. The second goal is to reduce threats of Yukon River salmon and their habitat throughout their life cycle. Goal 3 is to preserve the subsistence way of life and traditional and subsistence cultures along the Yukon River. And the fourth goal is to educate and provide accurate information to all Yukon River residents about salmon biology, management on the Yukon River, the Yukon River Salmon Agreement, and any issues affecting Yukon River salmon and their habitat. We have a slide later in this presentation where we'll talk more on our current and ongoing efforts and activities and how those activities fit within each one of these goals.
That's great, because I'm wondering just how the education and how you provide education out into these communities. So thank you.
You're welcome. Yep. Next slide, please.
For the record, this is Serena. This is actually my daughter, who graces our website as well. Usually, when fishing was more available, the opportunities were more available, I would take my family out to St. Mary's, and we would go help my family process fish. And this is my daughter when she was 7. That was the last time that she was able to cut salmon. And just want to say that, you know, why the Yukon River matters is, you know, as Brian said before, it's the longest wild salmon migration, one of the longest wild salmon migrations in the world. The Yukon River salmon are crucially important, largely owing to the fact that their journey represents one of the longest migrations undertaken by any fish species globally. This epic migration sees the salmon travel thousands of miles inland from the Bering Sea, navigating the vast network of the Yukon River watershed to reach their needle spawning grounds. This incredible feat of endurance is not only a biological marvel, but also forms the backbone of a complex ecological and cultural system. The health and abundance of the Yukon River salmon are thus essential, sustaining a rich array of wildlife and acting as a foundational resource for the indigenous people of the regions, whose traditional ways of life, subsistence, and cultural identity have been intertwined with the salmon for generations. The conservation of this fishery is therefore paramount, representing a vital effort to protect not just a species, but an entire ecosystem and the cultural heritage of the communities along the river. Next slide, please. The culture surrounding salmon is profoundly important to communities along the Yukon River, forming a cornerstone of their existence. This significance is deeply rooted in the intertwined aspects of subsistence, cultural identity, and the local economy. Salmon have been the primary subsistence resource, providing essential proteins and nutrients that sustains families throughout the long Alaskan and Yukon winters. The annual salmon runs is a period of intense activity involving traditional fishing methods, processing, such as drying, smoking, and freezing, and this sharing of our catch, all of which are integral to the food security and well-being of our communities. Beyond food, the relationship with salmon defines much of the cultural identity of Yukon River peoples. The knowledge, practices, and spiritual beliefs associated with salmon harvest and stewardship are passed down through generations, connecting people to their ancestors and to the river ecosystem. Fishing camps, stories, songs, and ceremonies are all centered on the cycle of our salmon, reinforcing community bonds and profound respect for the resource. Economically, the salmon resource supports vital livelihoods. While subsistence is paramount, commercial fishing along with related processing and tourism activities provide critical income in regions with limited employment opportunities. The health of the salmon runs deeply dictate the economic stability and future prosperity of these river communities. Therefore, the conservation and sustainable management of the salmon populations are not merely environmental concerns, but fundamental issues of cultural preservation, food security, economic survival of the people of the Yukon River.
And if we have I think this is our only presentation, so do you mind if we have questions or comments as we go along each slide? Ms. Alstrom?
Through the chair?
Yes.
Through the chair. Yes, you're open to ask any questions, interrupt us if you have questions.
Yeah, so for the committee, if you have any thoughts or questions, please let me know. On this slide, I just have a question about, you know, fish are important and they're seasonal and they only come like once a year. I know I went to fish camp every June on the Yukon River with my grandparents, and that was like our time. And then you had to catch as much as you can to make it last until the next season. So there's a lot of work in that preservation for the whole year. And I know that there was like one or two stores possibly in the villages that were near my community, where my grandparents lived. Is that true for all of these communities? Where else can you get food besides the fish?
Thanks for the question through the chair. It's the store, many of the communities have at least one store. Some communities don't have any stores. For example, the community of Beaver, which is not far from Rampart, does not have a grocery store. So usually what they do is they order food through Fairbanks and have it shipped to their home. Or when people travel to Fairbanks or Anchorage, they usually bring their groceries back with them. When I did reside in St. Mary's, we had two stores, and then we had one store after one of the stores burnt down. Every time I went to Anchorage, I would ship out dry goods through the post office. I would freight home additional frozen goods and have a tote with me at all times, traveling back and forth from Anchorage to St. Mary's. So it's very common for people from the communities to do mass shopping while they're in Anchorage or Fairbanks.
Thank you for sharing that. Yeah, I think that's a really important aspect of this, these circles. Like, just the, you know, you had to bring back totes. You have to travel with totes, which is really, you know, you have to think about that and always prepare, you know, for feeding your family, food security, but also subsistence, like following that subsistence calendar as well. So I appreciate that, giving us that look as well. Please proceed.
So with this slide, the connection, let's see, next slide, please. So if we go on to slide 9, okay. Our deep, enduring connection to the salmon is a foundational element of the community's identity and livelihood. For generations, these magnificent fish have been more than just a resource. They are a vital thread woven through our cultural heritage, economic stability, and environmental stewardship. The annual return of the salmon is a profound and celebrated event, marking the a promise of sustenance and renewal that has shaped our traditions, our spirituality, and our way of life. The relationship is built on respect, knowledge passed down through our oral history, and a commitment to sustainable practices, ensuring the health of the watershed and the continued abundance of the salmon for the future. We focus on our organization really ensures that the people on the Yukon River's voices are heard. Our staff commit to actively listening and addressing multifaceted concerns voiced by the people regarding the health, management, and sustainability of salmon populations. Our approach is founded on the belief that meaningful conservation and policy decisions must be informed by the diverse perspectives of fishermen, indigenous communities, scientists, local businesses, and environmental advocates. We understand that these concerns often encompass issues such as habitat degradation, the impacts of climate change, overfishing, management practices, and the long-term economic and cultural importance of salmon to the region. Therefore, we not only invite feedback, but we also actively seek out opportunities for dialogue, ensuring that experiences, traditional ecological knowledge, and scientific data provided by the stakeholders are central to developing effective and equitable solutions for the future of our salmon. And our last component is taking action. The people's concerns about the salmon drive our organization to develop the proper projects. The deep-seated concerns and passionate commitment of the local people regarding the health and sustainability of wild salmon populations are the core driving forces behind our organization's mission and ongoing activities. These communities' sentiments, which are often rooted in cultural tradition, economic necessity, and a simple appreciation for the natural world, serve as the essential impetus to us as to identify, develop, and meticulously execute the most relevant and effective conservation and management projects. We view the people's worries not as simple complaints, but as critical indicators of ecosystem health and urgent calls to action that guide our strategic plan and resource allocation.
Thank you. I have just a question. When you meet, when you have these meetings, do you meet on Zoom mostly? Because I read on a previous slide that you have two Canadian partners for the part of the river that is in Canada. And then, it's a 1,000-mile river. So how do the meetings look?
Through the chair, thank you for that question. We have a funded project through Pacific Salmon Commission, the Restoration Enhancement Grant. And we host an in-person meeting every year, which usually takes place in April. So ours is next month in Anchorage, April 21st and 22nd, and it's our Yukon River preseason meeting. And when fishing was more active and opportunities were there for subsistence and even commercial, we would host this meeting and focus our discussions around the upcoming season. So we partner a lot with the Alaska Department of Fish and Game and the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service managers to provide information and updates about the upcoming season, the outlook, how much fish they're projected to see in the river, talk about the opportunities for commercial and for subsistence use. And then they also get feedback from the people along the river. So we strategically fly in one representative from each tribe to participate in that meeting. Over the years, since we had complete closures for both subsistence and commercial fishing, we have moved more of that meeting to hear from the people of the Yukon River. And then more so started focusing on the current Chinook rebuilding plan that the Yukon is undertaking, the Yukon River panel, I'm sorry. So this year, our main focus is providing socio-cultural, socio-economical discussions from and getting information from the people to specifically put into that Chinook rebuilding plan for this year.
Thank you. That and how many of these in-person meetings have you had?
Thank you, through the chair. We for the Yukon River preseason meeting, we've had that meeting since 2001. So every year we've had a meeting. And when COVID came, we did have the meeting online, and we learned how to navigate Zoom. So we had very successful online meetings as well. Another in-person, our staff, and we really try to provide opportunities for our board to attend other meetings, such as the Yukon River Panel, the Federal Subsistence Board, the Board of Fisheries, also working with other organizations such as the Yukon River Intertribal Fish Commission, Tana Chiefs Conference, and Association of Village Council Presidents. We just try to make sure that the communication is really open, both, you know, with the managers and with the stakeholders, with the people on the river, the fishery users.
That's very helpful. Thank you. That's a lot of boards to keep track of when we all are trying to problem solve our fish here in Alaska. For the record, I would like to welcome Representative Underwood, who has joined us at 8:34. Good morning. We have a question. We have a couple of thoughts and questions that have come up. I'm going to go to Representative Carrick.
Thank you, through the chair, so much, Ms. Alstrom, for being here. And it's really great to hear from you about Yukon River Drainage Association. I, as a side note, I used to be the executive director of Tanana Valley Watershed Association, so I just have a lot of admiration for the work that you do. And I was curious about the funding mechanisms that help support the organization. It is a very tangled and complicated world in sort of watershed and fisheries management, and I've experienced that as well. And just curious how and kind of what sources Yukon River Drainage Fisheries Association receives funding from.
Well, thank you for the question. Through the chair, we are a nonprofit. We do apply for grants. We're always pushing grants out the door, both federal. We do have a state grant that's almost it's going to end in 2027, so it's coming up, and we're really proud of our work through that grant. And we will actually dive into some of the projects that we're doing in slide 10. But as for funding, it's looking for grants, seeing what's open. We've got a couple small foundation grants that have come through the door. We have some consistent donors that provide donations to our organization, which is very small amounts. Like I'm sure you in Juneau, you are familiar with Crystal Hurl. She provides a donation through Alaska Airlines through her work that had painted the salmon mural on one of the planes there, and so we get a yearly donation from Alaska Airlines through that, through her work. So it's a lot of planning, a lot of grant writing, keeping your eyes and ears open if there's an opportunity to do something. But yes, it's mostly grants.
Awesome. Thank you. Yeah.
Follow up.
And then thank you so much for that, through the chair. Also, just looking at how you partner with some of the other regional nonprofits, both in Alaska and Canada, and what does that look like? And do you have any like specific partnerships with other nonprofit organizations?
Yes, thanks for the question, through the chair. Yes, we do actually have quite a few partnerships with a lot of organizations and agencies. If we could move on to the next slide, I'm not sure if it's laid out, maybe just the projects that we focus on. If we'd like, we could kind of dive into the projects that we're doing on the next slide. Brian was going to provide some insight, and we're going to talk about some of our big projects that we're working on, if that's okay.
Perfect. That led right into the next slide. Anna Bossi, thank you. Mr. McKenna?
Thank you. For the record, this is Brian McKenna. And yeah, thank you for the questions, and it is a great transition to the slide. And again, please feel free to ask questions as we go. There's quite a bit in this slide. It probably should have been a few slides broken out. But yeah, please feel free to ask questions as we go. Okay. So earlier in the presentation, we reviewed the strategic plan and showed the four goals. So this slide is an attempt for us to show some of our ongoing efforts and activities in achieving those goals. These are some of our focus areas. They include communication and management. Another one that's not on the slide that should be is training and education, traditional knowledge, and then our research programs. So I think I'll pass it to Serena here to continue a little bit on the communication and management piece, and then we'll just move on from there. Thank you.
Okay, great. Ms. Ahlstrom?
Yes, for the record, this is Serena Ahlstrom. We can talk about the communication and management and some of the projects that we currently are operating. I talked about the preseason meeting, which happens every year in April, where it brings a representative from each tribe in person to talk about the upcoming season, to go over the management outlook that Alaska Department of Fish and Game and U.S. Fish and Wildlife provide, and also they do get feedback from the local users. Another project that we operate is the in-season teleconferences. So this project's been going on, again, since the early 2000s, say 2002 is when it started. And this project, every Tuesday, the first Tuesday of June to the last Tuesday in August, every Tuesday we get on the call, people call in, it's old school, you gotta use your phone, you put in your code, and we get representatives from the coastal communities from Hooper Bay, Chivac, and Scammon Bay, all the way to the headwaters of Teslin and Yukon Territory. And it's just another way for people to connect throughout this vast drainage, Yukon River drainage area, and provide, you know, community insights, environmental changes, things people are seeing along the river. And again, this project was actually started when there was fishing going on. And so people would be like telling us, okay, I had my net in, I know I had a good abundance, or maybe I didn't have any. And so it was another way for us to capture data on where the run was at, what the abundance looked like, and if people are seeing any kind of health changes from the salmon, because ichthyophonus was starting to develop more in the Chinook salmon, and people want to hear about whether it's, you know, if people are seeing the lower river or if they're seeing it in the upper river. And this project was primarily funded through the Office of Subsistence Management, through the federal program that grant that they have. And since they have not provided any grants over the last few years, we've kind of struggled to try to get this funded. However, a lot of the other organizations that we partner with, the Tana Chiefs Conference, the Yukon River Tribal Fish Commission, and some other personal donations from people has made this project continue for the last 3 or 4 years. So we've had other funding sources come through. They really enjoy this teleconference. You get to meet people up and down the river, and people are saying hi. It's just a beautiful way to connect and gather information during the season. Another communication tool that we do have, which is really great, is our quarterly newsletter. And we provide this in print. People can sign up to get a mailing. We recently started emailing the newsletter out digitally. We created a listserv, and we also provide it on our website. And this is another tool. We bring more information about research projects that we're doing, providing up information about upcoming meetings, having people talk about issues or concerns. So we do have people, some users provide their own opinion piece to our newsletter. So we have a lot of information, and it's grown over the years. That newsletter's funded through the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service under the Restoration and Management Grant. And that's just another great way to connect with people. And we try to use all different, you know, communication tools out there. We've done radio broadcasts, news broadcasts, and just going out to the communities as well is just another way of great communication. We've increased our community travel after COVID and try to go to different areas of the river every year. And since we've also increased some of got awarded other projects, our presence has been in these communities throughout the river. So we've been out on the river every year, and it just seems to get more busy. One of the other projects we started recently is the Yukon River Science Symposium. And I don't know if any of you are familiar with the AMSS Alaska Marine Science Symposium that happens every year at the end of January in Anchorage. We wanted to do a Yukon River specific science symposium, and we got awarded through U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service to host this symposium. The first year we had it was only online. And the last 2 years that we've hosted, we opened it up as a hybrid, and having it in Anchorage, again, opening it up to people that would like to join online. It's been quite successful. It's been growing every year. You know, this year will be our fourth year doing the symposium. And we try to highlight projects that are not in the limelight. The Yukon River panel does award projects both in the Canadian and U.S. Portions of the river, and we try to grab projects that are funded through that funding source. And it's been very successful. Like I said, it's growing every year. This year, we actually had to postpone our symposium. It was supposed to be next week on Tuesday, but we found out that the Board of Fisheries meeting started on Tuesday instead of Wednesday, so we decided to move it out, and we're looking at some dates in May. But we, like I said, highlight projects from both the Canadian and U.S. side, and projects that aren't really highlighted in other that are just kind of in the background, but we think are important as well. So just another tool in our pocket to utilize. There's a question about our partnerships, and we do have quite a few partnerships. We've tried to partner with everyone from management, Alaska Department of Fish and Game, to the Yukon River and Tribal Fish Commission. On several projects, usually after either our preseason meeting or other meetings that we attend, we usually get approached by an entity, seeing if we'd be open to partnering with them. Our current partners right now are ADF&G, Alaska Department of Fish and Game, U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, the University of Alaska Fairbanks, Tanana Valley Waterways Council, Trout Unlimited, Alaska Village Council, Association of Village Council Presidents, Tanana Chiefs Conference, Yukon River Intertribal Fish Commission, University of Boulder, Colorado, the Yukon River Panel, Yukon Salmon Subcommittee. So there's a lot of organizations and entities we work with, and you know, trying to partner as best we can and provide any kind of guidance or information to people that are wanting to, you know, gather data, do some research projects along the Yukon River. So we're very open.
Thank you for that breakdown. Are these partnerships on your website? And the website is yukonsalmon.org. Is that correct?
Yes, with Chair. That is correct. We are actually in transition. Our communication manager, Mike McIntyre, is revamping our website. So there might be some pages where they're not, they won't load. He's just trying to connect to a better server, and so if you see the connection not, or if the page not loading, that's why.
Okay, thank you for that. Thank you for that breakdown. I'm going to see if the committee has any questions. We have a question from Representative Carrick.
Thank you, through the chair. I really appreciate the list of the partnerships too. And I know that you had said a focus is doing public outreach, and I just was wondering if public broadcasting cuts have impacted your ability to get messaging out in some of the local communities, or have you seen an impact from cuts to public broadcasting?
Thank you, through the chair. Thank you for that question. We as a nonprofit, we do pay fees to like the Galena radio station, and we have seen not much of a change just through our organization, even with the radio station out in Bethel. KYUK, they actually been very involved with getting stories from the Yukon River communities and broadcasting. I haven't really seen much of a change on my end, but even with some communication grants that we try to apply for. And our recent, funder with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service under the Restoration Management Grant, that one is actually delayed, and that's our big funding source for our newsletters and for our communication to go out the door to the community. So that is going to be impacting our organization, and we're trying to find supplemental funds to continue that. Usually the call for proposals comes out in early January. They still haven't provided any call outs for proposals. When I reached out to the project managers, they told me that there might be a 6-month delay in funding. They still haven't put out the call. And so that's going to definitely impact our organization and the amount of information that's going to go out to our to the people on the Yukon River with no newsletters, maybe even having to, it might impact some employees as well. So it's quite concerning.
Thank you.
Okay, please proceed.
Okay, thank you again. This is Serena Alstrom. I'm gonna go into training and education. We have been, since we've been getting some funding through our organization, we wanted to provide some training and education to the people on the Yukon River. With no fishing opportunities for the last 5 to 6 years, we felt that we need to continue to keep the people busy. We need to provide them opportunities for other things. And so we've got awarded to provide biotechnician training. And we had one last year in Eagle, which was very successful. And this is taking people in the communities, getting them trained, and getting them geared up to be able to apply to jobs at assessment site projects with Alaska Department of Fish and Game or U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. So this is just a stepping stone for people to start working at projects along the river, not even along the river, through the whole state. This is actually a recycled project. YURTFA partnered with many other entities to provide a biotechnician training camp back in 2005, and that was very successful. Some of the people that were trained in that program worked at the Andrewski Fish Weir, at the pilot station sonar. I think one of the participants even worked on the Kuskokwim. And those trainees stayed there for 10 plus years. So it was a very successful program training local people to work at assessment site projects. Our next biotechnician training is going to happen this June in St. Mary's. And this is won't be our last training. We're still going to try to get some funds to provide other trainings from concerns and issues or concerns about from the people on the Yukon. One of the things that they did voice a few years back was we need to train our local people to work as to take over some of these positions that were they're flying in people from the lower 48, or they're hiring people that don't live along the river. And so we heard that loud and clear. And this is actually one of the trainings that came out of people's concerns and suggestions through our meetings that we'd have. Another project that we started is helping tribes with their culture camp. Ruby Tribe has been contracting our organization out for the last 3 years to help organize their culture camp, and it's been very successful. It's a week-long culture camp. They've had about, I believe, 56 people at the camp last year, and they had elders from Galena and from Koyukuk come down to Ruby to participate. One awesome thing about this camp that we started helping organize is the youth from the start help get their tents together. They work together to get camp set up and everything. They stay at the camp all week, but in the evenings, community members actually come and boat over and have dinner with everyone. And so that just gives another opportunity for storytelling and passing that knowledge down. We've had the opportunities to cut fish, even though they were not Yukon River salmon. Bristol Bay had flown in some fish for us to cut 1 year. Last year, we did apply for the educational permit, and we were actually the first organization to utilize that permit to actually take kids out on the river and throw a net in and catch some salmon. We did get a few. I was not there last year, but the project manager, Rachel Kingis Madras, was out with the kids, who's been an active fisherman in Ruby, lives out in Ruby, and is one of our staff members. And she she said it was just amazing to see the kids throwing the net, touch a salmon, a Yukon River salmon, and they were able to cut and prepare that for their potlatch, which happened a week later. So it was a very full circle event. This year, the camp is going to be in June, mid-June. And we're hoping with that is we're going to open the doors to the whole, all the communities along the Yukons, and pick maybe two or three communities to see if they'd like to help with their culture camps, so we could start being a little bit more focused, bringing even Western science. So we'll have that Western science and, you know, the traditional knowledge blend put together, and really hope to influence some of our youth to start engaging in our meetings, maybe looking at going to college and majoring in fisheries or marine resources, or even maybe work for us.
Wow, thank you so much for sharing that. I want to attend the camp. It sounds great. Are there any thoughts or comments, questions? We have a question from Representative Story.
Thank you very much, Director Ahlstrom, for being with us today. I am wondering, when you are doing the biotechnician trainings, what is the capacity for that? And is it like a week intensive? Can you give me an idea of the in-depth that they're able to do with that program? Thank you.
Yes. Thank you for that question through the chair. The training is about 10 days long. Last year was our first one that we put on. And we tried to limit the number of participants to 10, just so that we have a really good hands-on experience with the trainees, making sure that they get the proper and right training. And I'll even ask Brian to jump in. He was actually at Eagle last year helping out. And then this year I'll be in St. Mary's helping out. So we're just kind of tag teaming here. And he can talk more about the in-depth detail about the components that were in that training.
Through the chair.
Yes, Representative Story.
Yes, thank you for that. I would very much appreciate hearing that, and just also wondering if there's any micro-credentials or if you've been looking to partner with UAF or different. I know a lot of our high school programs are looking to partner and build these credentials going up, leading into other certifications. So just curious about that.
Thank you, through the chair. That's a great question, and that is something that we discussed when we started developing the curriculum for the training. So this training that's happening in St. Mary's is, I don't want to say our last, but it's as much as our funding will allow us. I did talk with the training coordinators with the Native American Fish and Wildlife Society, who also have a technician training. However, their training is more broad and not narrowly focused like ours is. And that is something that they were interested in as well, because we're so narrowly focused on, you know, weirs and sonars, and getting the right certifications for the participant to have to easily apply and apply for these assessment site project positions. And it is on my radar, because I do know Carrie Stevens, who's a professor at the Tribal College at UAF. Oh no, her name just escaped me. But yes, there are connections that we do have through the UAF system, and that has been something and discussed and something on our radar that we hope to do, and hope that maybe the university could start providing that opportunity on a regular basis.
Yeah, thank you for sharing that. Are we good to follow up?
Thank you, through the chair. My understanding was that we were going to hear from the biologist about the program, to the credentialed program.
Yeah. Mr. McKenna, did you hear the question?
I did. Thank you. Through the chair, appreciate the question, and I'd be happy to talk a little bit more in detail about the biotech training camp that we hosted in Eagle last summer, and the one that we'll be doing in June of this year in St. Mary's will be very similar in nature. I'll try to touch on recruitment and participation, our partnerships for the training, and then the topics that are covered within the training. So for recruiting, it was open to the entire Yukon River drainage. And we had participants last year from the coastal district in the lower Yukon, some from the communities in the lower Yukon. I believe there was one participant from the Middle River, another participant from the Porcupine drainage, and we had one participant from Eagle as well on the upper river. So we had a wide array of participants from throughout the river drainage, which is really nice. Our partnerships in planning this and delivering the different topics of training was a lot of the entities that Serena already mentioned. We had the federal manager from the Fish and Wildlife Service there. We partnered with the Alaska Department of Fish and Game to do a sonar training and visit the sonar site near Eagle. We partnered with the University of Alaska. They sent some folks to help cover an environmental DNA training. Who else do we have? We partnered with the State of Alaska DNR, who helped facilitate a boat education and safety training program. We had a lot of partners. I'm probably missing a few. Tanaw Chiefs Conference was another partner. They helped with electrofishing training. I know I'm still missing some, so I apologize. But it was a wider range of partners. It was a 10-day-long program. It was a mixture of classroom-style education and then in-the-field hands-on learning experience. So a lot of the days we kind of go like we start it in the morning in the classroom, we would cover a topic, and then we would migrate to the field to put that topic into action. So it was a really good mix of classroom and hands-on learning, which kind of limits, you know, we thought about trying to get more participants per training, but logistically we needed to cap that number around 10 participants just for the logistics involved. To cover some of the topics, we covered an overview of the Yukon fishery. It's everything from the biology and ecology and the current status of the run to management, management strategies. And that's where our partnership with the Fish and Wildlife Service and the federal manager being there was really helpful. We covered a lot of safety topics like first aid, CPR certification training, boater safety and certification training. We also did water quality monitoring, numerous gear types for deploying different gears to collect data. We covered environmental eDNA training, electrofishing training. We did an overview on drone applications and how that relates to fish and wildlife monitoring. There was a sonar technology training and then a site visit to the state's sonar project there in Eagle. And there was a resume building workshop where we identified a lot of the different types of assessment jobs that are available throughout the Yukon and the state, and then paired that with a resume building workshop and how to find those types of jobs and apply to those. I think I'll stop there and open up for questions, or we can continue moving on with slide 10.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. McKenna, for that breakdown of this wonderful camp. I'm curious, we have a couple of questions. Were elders involved in the week-long camp for that tech position, or is that because it's vacant? It's just curious. And then we have two more questions.
Yes, thank you. Through the chair. One of the days on the 10-day agenda was dedicated to go and meet with the village council in Eagle. And we had a long afternoon where we sat down and shared a meal and stories and met with the council there and some of the elders in the community as well. So that was a really good day that was on the agenda. Our TEK position was not filled, so that individual was not at the training last summer, but we're hoping to get that position filled, and I think that would be a part of this next training.
Thank you for that. I'm going to go to Representative Carrick, who has a question.
Thank you, through the chair. I really love hearing about this. I'm just amazed at all the things that you fit into a 10-day workshop. You said you had hosted an Eagle last summer and then St. Mary's this summer, and are folks able to join from communities that aren't the host community? And also, can you, after this hearing, send information about advertising for the camps so that we could potentially include it, each of us here, in our outreach to folks?
Yes, through the chair, this is Serena, for the record. Our training in St. Mary's is open to anyone along the Yukon River. Our main priorities for participants are from the Yukon River drainage, and then if we don't get enough applicants, we'll open it up to anyone. We got good feedback already. We will send some information to you about the training and anything else that we are advertising for, such as our symposium, our latest issue of our newsletter, and some of the other things that we're planning for this summer.
Very cool. Thank you.
Great. Yeah, I probably am guessing there's a wait list to get into this camp because it sounds amazing.
Through the chair, yes, we had a good list last year of participants. You know, we did call people, and our wait list actually kind of fizzled out because of the fire season. A lot of the applicants were firefighters as well, and so they went out and were firefighting, and some of them that we talked with were like in transition. They just got back from the field and that they were going to get deployed again the next 3 days. But they were actually interested in, they were like, if you guys have another training, you know, put my application through. I still want to participate in this training. So we kind of moved those participant applicants over to the St. Mary's season. So the St. Mary's training that'll happen in June.
Okay. And we have a question from Representative Story.
Thank you, through the chair. Thank you for this information. My question is, what for the jobs, the assessment jobs that this, what would I call it, this training provides, the 10-day training, what are the minimal qualifications? And when these people can finish the 10-day training, does that allow them to apply for the job, or do they need to go and get some more micro-credentials or some other type of training? Thank you.
Ms. Alstrom?
Yes, thank you for the question, through the chair. When we first started developing the training, our first question was, what type of qualifications do they need to apply for positions at assessment sites, such as fish weirs or sonars, counting towers, and some of the, what are the opportunities that they don't get to do in many of the rural communities. So we had meetings with management managers, fishery managers from areas that operate these assessment site projects to provide us with knowledge and things that we would need to train local people to work at these sites. And I'll ask Brian for some assistance here, and because he started off at working on assessment site projects, and he was a great asset to the training. I think that providing some of these training aspects, these components, to get people hired, such as first CPR training. We don't, you know, a lot of the rural communities don't offer that, or you have to fly to the nearest hub to get training in, for first aid, CPR. Boat and safety training was another component where it was necessary for them to have that training to work at an assessment site project. You know, unfortunately, it's like that, working with the state or the federal government at these sites. They do have to boat to many of the assessment site projects. A lot of them grew up operating boat, probably since they were old enough to drive and navigate the water. And talking with the managers, you know, there was some moments where, like, you know, it just doesn't seem right. But, you know, that's something that they would need to that they'd need to apply for some of these positions. I'll go ahead and hand it off to Brian because he has more in depth about what is needed and necessary to work at these sites.
Yeah, hopefully they pass. Thank you, Serena. Hopefully they pass the boat training in the first day. Mr. Yes. McKenna.
Thank you, through the chair. Yeah, I'll try to expand on that a little bit. So, yes, some of those trainings that are required, especially through the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, can seem kind of redundant or leaves you asking the question, why are we doing this? But that's what's required from the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service for those types of positions. First aid CPR, that is a certification that individuals can come in with and can give folks a leg up for getting these positions. But the boat training and also a firearms and bear training are two trainings that, even if you're well qualified already, those are trainings that you have to complete within the Fish and Wildlife Service. They provide those trainings in the first couple weeks of that position. So it's something that we tried to give a little bit of experience on if individuals need it. Like Serena said, many individuals come in already knowing how to drive a boat for many, many years. And know how to use firearms and are very aware in bear country. So that's something that we kind of left off of our training curriculum because we felt like most individuals would already have that experience. And then also if they're going to work for the Fish and Wildlife Service, they're going to be required by the Fish and Wildlife Service to complete those trainings regardless. On the state side, it's a little less stringent, I guess, with those types of training. Still really good to have those, certainly first aid CPR. We worked with the state to do the boater certification and safety course, so those are really, really helpful. And then I guess just kind of like a case example here. So the training last year in Eagle, one of the aspects of that training was an overview of sonar technology and principles coupled with a site visit to the Eagle sonar station. And we happened to get lucky, and we had one applicant or participant from Eagle last summer who showed a really strong interest in possibly getting a job at that sonar station this coming summer in 2026. So through that, he was able to learn about sonar principles, technologies, applications, and then go to the site, actually see it in use, and then meet with ADF and G staff and develop those connections. So through that training, not only did that individual get some experience, but he's also able to meet, shake hands with, and learn faces and names of the people responsible for hiring those positions. So it'd be really, really curious to see this coming summer if that individual followed through with that and will end up being employed at the Eagle Sonar.
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. McKenna. Looking to the committee, no further comments right now. Please proceed.
Thank you, through the chair. This is Serena Alstrom. There's one last training and education component that I'd like to talk about before we move on, and that's the Cultural Educational Exchange Program. And this exchange program happens between Canadians and Alaska participants, and we alternate every year. We'll be hosting six Canadians, and we'll be traveling to the communities of Emonic, St. Mary's, and Pilot Station. And this has also is a longstanding program funded through the Yukon River Panel, through the RN Restoration and Enhancement Grant, and also helped with the planning portion of it through their communication committee, which I also serve on. And we work closely with the Canadian organization, the Yukon Salmon Subcommittee out of Whitehorse, and together we have managed this education program. So right now they have their flyers out. They're trying to recruit six people from the Canadian watershed to come to Alaska, and we bring them down. We've mainly been traveling down to the Lower Yukon area just to show the Canadians what the mouth of the Yukon River looks like, and we were able to visit assessment site projects there down at Emonic. Alaska Department of Fish and Game has their office down there, and they also take samples through their test fishery that they operate. We're able to actually go to the Yukon Delta, YDFDA, Yukon Delta Fisheries Development Association, which is part of the CDQ, the Community Development Quota under the North Pacific Fisheries Management Council, to go to their fish processing plant. And since commercial fishing has been closed on the Yukon River, they've migrated from fishery processing to farming. And so we're able to go down there and see what changes that they have made to try to keep employment up, youth engaged, the community engaged, and working. So we'll be able to visit their site and see how they transformed from fish processing to gardening. Then we'll migrate up to St. Mary's. St. Mary's was also a community where we had a fish processing plant, an independent processor, and they had closed their doors back in, I believe, 2019. And so we'll be able to go there, talk with many elders. We'll be visiting a fish camp, spending the whole day at someone's fish camp, and really engage with the community at St. Mary's. We will then go to Pilot Station and go to the Pilot Station sonar. So the Pilot Station sonar is the first major assessment site that reports, at least in the main stem, it reports the abundance level, the number of fish that are passing through. They usually provide their counts every day, and people really look at that to see if there's going to be opportunities for subsistence fishing, since there's no more commercial fishing along the Yukon. So that's the first assessment site that people really focus on. We'll bring the Canadians there to show them how the sonar operates. We'll hand it off to Alaska Department of Fish and Game sonar crew to educate us on the sonar process. We like to visit sonars because over the years through our in-season teleconferences, through our in-person meetings, a lot of concerns over how sonar operates and the data it collects has always been in question, and providing hands-on site visits and even presentations about sonar, it's the best available tool in our pocket to see what's entering the river. And so it's really great to visit the sonar sites. Like I said, this is we alternate our visits. So next year I'll be recruiting 6 Alaskans to travel over to Canada. Usually when we go to Canada, since most of the communities are on the road system, we utilize that. Our last visit, we actually were in Whitehorse, Dawson, and we flew up to the community of Old Crow, which is on the Porcupine River. And that was one of the first times throughout this long-standing program that we were able to travel to Old Crow. You know, Old Crow is very remote, like many of our Yukon River communities are. So it's they have to get everything flown in. It's a community of about 200 people. So it was very similar, and it kind of reminded me of my hometown of St. Mary's. So it was very, very welcoming. We got to meet with a lot of elders. We got to visit the Porcupine sonar and travel throughout the Porcupine River and looking at different ways that they do fish up there and how they manage their resources, which is very different from the U.S. side, the Alaska side. And that's just a really great program, and we're actually trying to mimic that educational exchange program, not only for the Yukon River, but outside of the drainage. So we'll be able to bring people from the Yukon River to other places. There's been talk about Bristol Bay, going down to Bristol Bay, even the Kuskokwim, with the Kuskokwim Intertribal Fish Commission, and more recently, across industry, from inland Yukon River communities to the North Pacific Fisheries Management Council, pollock industry. So there's been, we actually just came back from, Brian and I just came back from a training, the Marine Resource Education Program, and learned about the marine environment and all the fisheries and research data that's going on out there. So, and that was, that's something now being discussed. So hopefully we'll be able to expand our education program just beyond the Yukon River drainage.
Thank you for giving us that high overview. It's very amazing work that you all are doing. We have a question from Representative Story.
Thank you, Chair Dybert. Through the chair, you had talked about when you went up to Old Crow that they were doing some different managed fisheries management practices. Could you elaborate on that, please?
Thank you, through the chair. That's a great question, which is our participants from Alaska, whenever we do travel to Canada, they're very... their eyes are wide open with the different management practices for their resources in Canada. The First Nations of Canada are actually the resource managers. So it's not the government of Canada or the Yukon Territory. It's the First Nations that manage their resources there. So it's very, when we do bring Alaskans there, it's they're just taken back at that, because there's like, we don't manage our resources, our tribes, our consortia, our native people don't manage our natural resources. And in Canada, it's They do. So it's very eye-opening, and it's very interesting to see the differences and the questions that come up between the participants from Alaska and from Canada and their dialogue. It's a very rewarding experience, in my opinion.
Wow, that is interesting. So they probably don't have to, I wonder, like boating certificates, and you know, I'm sure that all looks very different when it comes to the training like that. Do you have a follow-up?
Yes, follow-up. I was just wondering if there was any like besides training, anyway, if at any time there are any unique practices they were doing that we were not doing, that would be of interest to me. Thank you.
Ms. Alster.
Through the chair, thank you for that question. The First Nations, so when we do have our in-season teleconferences during the summer, we do have Department of Fisheries Oceans Canada online, as long as First Nations. And First Nations, they do provide recommendations for the management of their resources. So with fishing in general, or in, specifically for fishing, is they stand down, and they've been standing down for the last 30 years for salmon fishing because of the very low numbers that have been going into Canada. And usually most of the communities get fish flown in. For example, Teslin Tlingit Council has their fish flown in from the Taku River on the Alaska side. And they have their fish ceremonies. They call it the first fish. They also have ceremonies up in Old Crow area, Dawson area. So each First Nation has their own way of celebrating First Fish without the Yukon River fish. They felt that since they haven't been fishing for decades, that they still needed to continue to celebrate the salmon, even the few that do enter. And when I say few, it's a few. So for example, on the Porcupine River, a couple years ago, the sonar only captured 700 and I believe 15 Chinook that had passed. It was, and I, don't quote me, I want to say Chinook or Chum, and I can't recall which species, but it was, you know, even just the 700 number just takes me, it's unbelievable that only that we're in the hundreds instead of the thousands when we're talking about fish returns to the upper reaches of the Yukon River.
Thank you for a follow-up. Mm-hmm. Just thank you for adding that. Appreciate it.
Yeah, that is very sad. When I think about my own grandparents on the Yukon River, they would catch 700 fish in a summer. So that was just one family, but we've shared the food with multiple, you know, families. And I just wanted to do a time check. We are at 9:30, and we have 30 minutes left. So please proceed. Thanks, Ms. Alstrom.
I agree. Well, thank you, through the chair. Again, my name is Serena Alstrom. Those three components, communication, management, and training, education components are kind of our core projects that we try to develop in our organization. But with each of our projects that we do operate and we do try to develop and get funding for, we try to incorporate traditional knowledge into all of them. It's really important to integrate that into any research or management activities that we do, because many of the research projects, as you know, they include a lot of scientific, a lot of numbers, whereas traditional knowledge is more brought down through stories and through areas. One good example about blending our traditional knowledge with our with Western science is we partner a lot with Alaska Department of Fish and Game to nominate streams that have salmon spawning. It's called the, I always mess up this word, and Brian's probably going to laugh at me, but the Andronymous Waters catalog. So I hope I got that right, the AWC catalog. So we nominate streams for that catalog. And what we usually do is we go into the communities, or, you know, the ADF and Alaska Department of Fish and Game usually reaches out to us and say they want to, they got funding to go into this area. Can you help us with coordinating with the nearest communities? And when we first started doing this, it was to reduce the cost, because, you know, if they didn't have the traditional knowledge that, you know, with these interviews that we conduct first and saying, okay, we come in with a map, we look at, we talk with the elders, with the community members, and ask, okay, it's this stream. Have you seen salmon spawning in the stream? And, you know, we have certain questions that are developed. And then we transcribe them, provide it back to the community just to make sure everything's correct, that we got everything correct. And then we work with the Alaska Department of Fish and Game, and it really reduced the costs. Otherwise, you know, ADF&G, Alaska Department of Fish and Game, would probably spend weeks out there trying to navigate all these streams and trying to find where salmon are spawning, when we already have that information with the people within the community who have lived there for generations. So that's one way where traditional knowledge and Western science really work well together, and just providing providing information and feedback to each other. We know where the salmon are spawning. We can count and see what kind of species and amount of salmon are spawning in that area, bring it back to the community, and it's just a perfect blend of Western science and traditional knowledge. And I will toss it off to Brian to talk about some of the research projects and maybe future projects that we're looking into.
Thank you. Mr. McKenna?
Thank you, through the chair. For the record, this is Brian. So, yeah, thanks, Serena. So as Serena mentioned, you know, the traditional knowledge we try to blend into all of our research. A lot of our research projects are multidisciplinary, so they include ethnographic interviews to collect the traditional knowledge. Then that knowledge is used to help inform our scientific approach and the methods. The AWC, or Andronymous Waters Catalog, was a great example of that. All of our research projects are intended to have direct impacts on the Yukon River fisheries. So not just research for the sake of research, but to actually affect the fishery. When I think about our projects, there's kind of two types of research. So you have like just basic research, which I don't like that word, but it's kind of foundational or baseline research. And then there's applied research, but both of these types have direct management implications and help enable sustainable fisheries. So the foundational research, when I think of that, that's expanding our understanding of like baseline fisheries information. A couple of good examples would be the Andronymous Waters Catalog, which Serena already mentioned. Another really good example would be Yukon River genetic baselines. So if you're not familiar with genetic baselines, they're a tool that managers can use. Genetic baselines establish a stock of origin for each salmon species and distinct spawning populations. And that's a tool that managers can use to help manage mixed stock fisheries, such as those that exist on the Yukon. So this is a really important tool for Yukon River salmon management. because like I said, the Yukon is a mixed stock fishery. It's home to all five Pacific salmon species. There's two different distinct stocks of chum salmon, summer run and fall run. With Chinook salmon, there's over 183 unique individual spawning populations throughout the drainage, not to mention all the countless individual spawning populations for chum, coho, sockeye, and pink as well. So it's a really in-depth mixed stock fishery, so that's a really important tool for helping manage that. Switching gears to the applied research, I think of applied research projects, that the goal of those would be to like solve more immediate issues or problems. And a really good example of that is the Andrevsky River, located near St. Mary's. Andrevsky River salmon populations have been monitored using a weir. The Fish and Wildlife Service monitored those populations for the last 30 years. But the weir was decommissioned last year in 2025, and that left behind a critical data gap. The Andrevsky River is one of the first major spawning tributaries in the Yukon River. So it's a really critical indicator that helps inform in-season management decisions. So that would be a good example of a need for like immediate applied research. And that kind of segues nicely into the future projects. We have several projects on the horizon. Some we've already kind of talked about. So we have a cooperative agreement that's being developed right now with the Alaska Department of Fish and Game for the next 3 years to help establish and refine genetic baselines for Yukon River coho salmon populations throughout the Yukon River drainage. Another project we're also working with the Alaska Department of Fish and Game on is a joint research project investigating life histories of salmon in the Yukon Coastal District. That's going to be starting later this year. We'll be working with the communities of Chivac and Scammon Bay to really learn about the salmon populations in those coastal rivers. Right now, those rivers are part of the Yukon management plan, but those rivers don't actually connect to the Yukon River itself. So this project could have direct implications on how those rivers near those communities are managed. Through that project, some of the goals are to document the traditional knowledge, and then to, as Serena was mentioning, to use that traditional knowledge to help describe salmon presence, abundance, to inform the anadromous waters catalog, to establish stock of origin through genetic analyses. So we're really looking forward to that project. That one has been funded, and it will be starting later this year. And then to get back to the Andrevsky River and that kind of more immediate call to action, we're currently in the process of developing a new drone-based salmon monitoring program to help fill that data gap that was created when the weir was decommissioned last year. We're in the initial stages of this program, but we have secured funding that's going to enable us to begin a training program. So again, more partners, because our list of partners just keeps going. But we have a new partnership that we're developing with Nalakuk. They're a native-owned business in Quinnahawk, and we're going to be working with them to train residents from St. Mary's. We're going to recruit folks that would like to get trained and certified to become FAA-certified drone pilots that can help with a local drone-based monitoring program out of St. Mary's. So the funding for that's been secured for the training program, and that's going to be happening in June in Quinnahawk. And then the next steps moving beyond that initial training are we're currently seeking funding that would let us conduct a feasibility study on the Andrevsky River. So that would be where we integrate the local and traditional knowledge, pair that with drone technology and remote sensing techniques to kind of develop a local monitoring program for the Andrevsky. So that's something we're actively working on. We're looking right now for various funding sources that might be able to help fund that project. And then lastly, I did say at the start that slide 10 was going to go on. I think we could have turned this into maybe 10 more slides. But just to give a couple of shout-outs here, all of the images in this presentation were Yurt for stock images, with the exception of the two images on the right side of your screen there. I just wanted to give photo credits here to some of our partners. So the third image on the right there of Charlie Wright holding a Yukon king salmon. Photo credit to Tana Chiefs Conference. Charlie was working with them in 2024, helping them with their mid-river sonar feasibility study. So that image was captured of him helping that project near Tana in 2024. And Charlie's one of our long-term board members on YRTFA. And then the image on the far right is from our new partners at Nalakuk and the Alaska Ocean Observing System. That image was taken of residents employing a local drone monitoring program out of Quinnahawk. I believe that was it was either last year or in 2024. I forget, but just wanted to give a shout out to our partners there. And I think that wraps up slide 10. I'll turn it over to Serena there if she wants to add anything.
Thank you, Mr. McKenna. We have a question from Representative Story.
Yes. Thank you, Chair Jibert. Through the chair to Mr. McKenna, could you tell me, please, why the Andreski River Weir was decommissioned? And then my other question was, that's great that you have this new drone-based project for training. Is there money for the people who are getting the training? There's money to deliver the training, but do the people receiving it, are they paid for their time?
Thank you for the question. Through the chair. all right, so why was the WEIR decommissioned, and then about the training program? So the WEIR was decommissioned last year by the Fish and Wildlife Service, and just a little bit of history on the Yukon. Historically, there was three WEIRs throughout the Yukon River drainage, the Andreski River WEIR in the lower drainage. Then there was two WEIRs, the Henshaw Creek WEIR and the Gasaza River WEIR. Both of those were in the Koyukuk drainage. All three WEIRs were started by the Fish and Wildlife Service in the mid to late 90s and had roughly 25, 30-year lifespans. The reasons why they have been discontinued, there's multiple reasons. One reason is kind of a mismatch with a changing climate. So a weir, if you're not familiar with it, it's kind of like an underwater fence that blocks passage and forces salmon through a funnel to be counted and sampled. Those weirs worked really well for a long time period, but starting in like the mid-2000s and certainly as we get closer to today, all three weirs experienced severe damages and blowouts and pauses in operation due to increased precipitation events and flooding, flash flooding in these systems that would kind of wash out the weir and damage it. So there was many years where data could not be collected due to high water, and then also with damages associated with the high water, the weirs had to be either rebuilt or significant repairs that would keep them down for the remainder of a season, sometimes even going into the next season. So kind of a mismatch with climate change and changing river conditions. I believe funding was also a reason, and I'm just taking a stab here because these were Fish and Wildlife Service projects, but I believe funding related issues as well, and maybe hiring issues as well. Serena, did you want to add anything on that part of the question?
Thank you. This is Serena Alstrom. No, I don't have anything to add other than that as we navigate through these times where there's no assessment sites being done, it's concerning because most of our fishing opportunities are based on these assessment sites and whether or not the abundance is there to provide opportunities to fish. So that was a big concern of ours as an organization, and many of these sites that are being decommissioned, not operating after having a long-standing data set, and we want to make sure that continues. And I think that's very important, and it also provides opportunity for local people to really take a step up and get trained and start working at these assessment sites. And that's what we're trying to do, is trying to keep things going and improve local hire.
Thank you. Follow-up?
Just thank you for that information. Just for my clarification, so it sounds like that was decommissioned for a few reasons, but primarily not funding, and so that was something that was disagreed, your organization disagreed with, but you are pivoting to help more with drone assessments now. Did I understand that correctly?
Mm-hmm. Yep. Ms. Alstrom?
Yes, through the chair, this is Serena. Thank you for that question. It's our concern is just is the assessment sites not in operation. Like I said, a lot of the fishing opportunities that are offered are based on the abundance of salmon that are coming into our rivers. And when there's no assessment site projects to look at the abundance and show the abundance, then how are we gauging to provide that opportunity to fish? We do have main stem sonars, and our organization believes that we can't just rely on one source. Even with when there was opportunity to provide some fishing, the fishermen was also another way to gauge the abundance of fish that were coming in, and with nobody fishing, it just shows another. It doesn't have a way to provide that abundance level. The funding through U.S. again with this is, these projects are operated by U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, and you know, I can't provide the detail of why these projects were not being funded, but one way our organization was looking at it is you know, this is just a different way to provide an assessment site, and Brian can elaborate on using drone technology rather than a sonar, or I'm sorry, a weir, would be more beneficial and providing maybe a reduced cost to the operation. And I will throw it over to Brian to let him elaborate on that.
Thank you, Ms. Hallstrom. And before we go to Brian, I'm just doing a time check of 10 minutes left. Okay. And I know we just have like a beautiful slide with some photos. I want to make sure we get to that and then leave a few minutes for any other last comments. Mr. McKenna?
Thank you. Through the chair, to answer the second part of that first question, the drone training event that we'll hold in June in Quinnahawk, we're currently recruiting individuals from St. Mary's to participate in that. It will not be a paid training, but it'll be free to the individuals who participate, so we will cover the cost of travel, stay per diem, and the training fee itself. So it'll be a free training, and then following that up, we're still looking for funding, but assuming we can find funding to initiate the feasibility study, that's where we will be creating employment opportunities for the individuals who receive the training.
Thank you for that. And we have a question from Representative Schwanke.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And maybe we can move to the next slide if you are ready. I kind of have a science question for you. So I might be the only biologist on the committee here. So I'm fascinated with the presentation, and I'm very thankful for you for your time today, all of you. One of my biggest concerns for Yukon Chinook in particular is the ichthyophonus, and I'm very curious if through your broad reach and all your communities, if you have If you've utilized technology such as temperature data loggers in different communities and small spawning streams, because it seems like that's been one of the biggest topics that's been discussed is warmer in-river temperatures. And I was curious if you had any kind of thoughts or data on increased or stable or declining ichthyophonus in specifically adult Chinook.
Through the chair, thank you for that question. This is Serena. And it does actually go into the next slide with the pictures. There's a couple of other smaller projects that we did conduct and we're actually wrapping up this year. And that's with the NPRB. let's see if I get this acronym right. National Board... Research Board. I'm sorry. I'm so used to calling them with all their acronyms. It's really hard to get them right sometimes.
I'm a teacher. We have a lot of acronyms.
Through the chair, I will help out. It's the North Pacific Research Board.
Okay, great. Thank you so much. I appreciate that, Brian. It's just, yeah, we've got so many acronyms, and I'm really not trying to say them, so you guys will understand or which entity I'm talking about. But we do have a couple projects through NPRB. So back in 2019, when there was a significant heat event, and there was witnesses on the Koyukuk River in Huslia and in St. Mary's on the Andrewski River, where salmon were found belly up and floating down the river. And a lot of the community members were reporting temperatures in the mainstem Yukon at like 72 degrees. And that is very, very warm, to the point where many of that creates a heat stress for the salmon. So we developed these two projects, which is a Climate Drivers project and an Engaging Fishers project. With the Engaging Fishers project, there was two objectives in that project. One of them was to interview local people at the mouth of the Yukon River, indicating changes in the salmon health, in the size and length of salmon through their local knowledge. And the second component of that project was to continue community monitoring, temperature monitoring in those streams, establishing a response team in these communities if another heat event was to occur, and that they would be, again, using local people to be the first responders, to get trained in taking samples, to monitor the temperature, to be the first responders of these salmon, so we wouldn't have to waste any time for a biologist to come out and do all of the work that is necessary to capture what's going on with the salmon during this heat event. So so that project is wrapping up, and in St. Mary's and Huslia, there is heat response teams. There has been temperature loggers deployed every summer for the last 3 years. And we've been utilizing not only our clearinghouse platform to keep that data, but also sharing that data with another collaborator, AK Temp, through the University of Alaska Anchorage, where the site collects water temperature throughout the state of Alaska and keeps a log. The climate drivers portion of this project is going up to salmon spawning areas in these tributaries, counting carcasses, checking whether or not they have spawned out successfully or not, taking tissue samples to indicate their fat content, which is the thiamine levels of the salmon, to see if they were healthy enough and they had fat content to make it that far into the river system, and how it influences even the health of the eggs, because the thiamine levels do indicate the health status of not only the salmon but the eggs as well. That project is ending later on this summer. Our data is not ready to be released, but we'll definitely have a report out before the fall season. I'll go ahead and maybe dive into this last slide since we are at top of the hour.
Yeah.
And just kind of conclude with some assessment numbers for the NCMU fund.
Yeah, we are at the top of the hour. Is it all right if we go a few minutes over? Okay, yes. Well, please proceed very quickly.
Thank you, through the chair. So this last slide is just put together. Our staff, local people getting hired. We just want to have a placeholder for, to talk about other things that are going on in the Yukon. But our staff gets trained through, doing different things. I believe that's an electrofisher from our biotech training that occurred. And then our staff on the far right side are getting trained to, they're actually collaborating or calibrating their water testing equipment to get some training in gathering that data. A big part of our organization too is empowering local people to advocate. And we have on the bottom middle photo there, we have one of our fishery users from Nunam Iqwa, which is at the mouth of the Yukon River, providing testimony. And then the top middle picture is the sonar station at the Klondike Sonar River in Canada. And our educational exchange members were getting trained there. But before I do end, I do want to provide you guys with some management overview of the Yukon and the current status of our fisheries on the Yukon. And historically, and I know Brian, if you want to jump in and talk about this, the numbers, our current state, and then our 7-year agreement.
Mr. McKenna, very quickly, you can put yourself on record.
Thank you, through the chair. For the record, this is Brian McKenna. Just to talk about kind of the current status of the Yukon. Let's talk about Chinook salmon. So historically, the Chinook salmon run coming into the Yukon River annually was around 400,000 plus or minus. And then it's been a downward trend for a few decades now, starting in the 90s, I believe. But looking at just the most recent times, the last 4 years, 2022 through 2025, the annual Chinook salmon run size entering or that came into the Yukon in total was between 37,000 and 60,000 Chinook salmon. So again, that's not quite 400,000 of the historical run abundance. So significant decreases there. Just want to make note of that. On the management side, there's a current 7-year agreement that was put in place in 2024 running through 2030. And this involves a new border passage goal. It's the number of Chinook salmon that need to pass into Canada per the Pacific Salmon Treaty. And that's 71,000 Chinook salmon. And just for reference on that number, the last time the Yukon achieved a border passage of 71,000 or more Chinook salmon was in 2017. And that goal of 71,000 has only been met 5 times in the last 20 years. What that means for the people on the river is that if the goal is not met in a year, the fishery will remain closed as it has been for the last several years. And I don't have the numbers in front of me for chum and coho, but both of those species are also experiencing declines as well.
Thank you so much for sharing those somber numbers with us. And that just makes your work more meaningful that you are doing in your program. I'm so glad that you're including voices from boots on the ground, from rural communities. I'm trying to bring our numbers back and working with Canada, all the small villages. I know that my grandparents taught me. I went to fish camp on the Yukon River growing up doing that, and my mom recently told me, at least you and I, we have our memories of fishing and preserving salmon and having fish all winter. So hopefully we could not make this a memory for our grandchildren and our great-grandchildren, but bring those numbers back. And through your work, it sounds like our committee needs to do more work in this area, whether it's looking at sonars, drones, fishing wheels, and learning more about the weirs. So hopefully we'll look into that. Representative Story.
Thank you, Chair Divert. I was going to suggest to the committee that we write a letter to the Department of Fish and Wildlife and ask about the decommissioning of the three weirs and their rationale for that. Is it funding? I agree with the executive director that we should have a couple of assessment sites and not just a couple of measures. And so it would be helpful to me to know about the decision behind that. So I just would ask for committee support or discussion about that.
Great suggestion. Any other follow-ups or thoughts? Thank you so much for staying over a few minutes. This is important work. And before I wrap up, I wanted to give a moment to Representative Freer.
Thank you, Chair Divert, for the opportunity. Thank you for the presentation. I'm from up north and a little bit bigger fish up there. Just kidding.
Seals.
But I just wanted to, take this opportunity at the end of Tribal Affairs to kind of reiterate, what I said yesterday during other announcements on the floor and recognize that today is March 12th again, Ashley Johnson Barr Day, and I appreciate everyone who's wearing purple. I don't really have a whole lot of purple. Today would have been her 18th birthday, and I have an 18-year-old son, and I think about that, and I also have young children, as do many of us. And I wanted to just once again invite folks to the lunch reception that we're having with our village public safety officers, who are going to talk about, the importance of, having public safety in our in our smaller communities, and kind of more about their program and what it looks like in the Northwest Arctic as well as down here with Clinton and Haida. So just want to invite you all there again. It's not going to be very long because they've got to turn it over for finance, but wanted to put that plug out there for folks that are listening as well. Thank you, Chair Divert.
Anabasi, for that. Anabasi, to our presenters, thank you so much for being here. I look forward to working with you on further learning about this subject. That completes the agenda for our meeting today. Again, a big thank you to our presenters. For committee members, my office will be in touch later this afternoon for our hearing scheduled for next week. The time is 10:09 a.m., and this hearing is now adjourned.